Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
In some of my songs, I have casually mentioned the fact that I like to drink beer. This little song is more to the point. Roll out the barrel and lend me your ears. I like beer. It makes me a jolly good fellow. I like beer. It helps me unwind and sometimes it makes me feel mellow.
Welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. It's Tuesday, November 8th, 2011. I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43. Here we are on Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm joined tonight by Dave Broderick from Blind Tiger and Jen Swartman from Blind Tiger as well.
Hey, Jimmy.
How are you guys?
Very good.
Doing really, really well.
Well, you know, I heard the coolest thing happened this weekend at Blind Tiger. What was going on?
We did our annual Vermont Farm to Bar event, and actually this year was a fundraiser just because of Hurricane Irene. A lot of our farmers got kind of crushed up there, and so we brought one of those farmers down that we were raising money for along with another group, Helping Hands, which is in my town up there. And then Johnny and Christopher Piana that run our CSA in Barnard, they brought a ton of veggies down, which our chef cooked up and did a big buffet, and we had some Alchemist Teddy Topper and some... Wow. Hill Farmstead, Nelson Sylvan.
Dave, you're Mr. Beer. You're a Blind Tiger guy, but you live in Vermont a lot. Well, what do you live, like 2 weeks of the year, 3 weeks of the
month? I'm there three quarters of the time now.
Wow.
Except, you know, when you drag me down here.
So is there good beer in Vermont?
There is. We've got a lot of great beer there, actually. And I think some of the best hoppy beers right now on the East Coast are coming out of there between Alchemist, Hill Farmstead, and Sean Lawson and Lawson's Finest. So it's pretty good. It wasn't that way necessarily 10 years ago when I first started living up there, but it's amazing now.
There's a lot of talent in that state in All brewing.
Right. We'll put them up against anybody right now on the West Coast. And actually one of them was trying to organize sort of a IPA off between San Diego and Vermont. And it hasn't happened yet, but I think it should.
Is that what we're drinking right now? This strong.
Well, this is from Northern wine? California, from Petaluma. This is the gnarly wine from Lagunitas.
All right, so this is like a taste of the West Coast.
Yeah,
this
it's 2008.
This is vintage too. Yeah,
Mark got it from Beercraft, and it's phenomenal.
Wow. Well, on that note, let's give a shout out to our sponsor, greatbrewers.com. They bring the American beer community together on greatbrewers.com. It's all about the beers, and support by Good Beer Seal. Check out goodbeerseal.com, an association of 34 New York City beer bars. All right. Well, here we are on the show. If you want to Twitter us, it's @beer_sessions. I think Twitter is the new way to go. We had a show last month with @TimBiesecker, and we had some people from all around the country, and that was pretty cool. Did you guys listen to that show?
I haven't listened to it yet.
Yeah,
it's pretty neat. You know, if anyone's out there, you can Twitter in questions, @beer_sessions, and we'll answer it right from here.
That'd be fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we talked about Vermont. We got Lagunitas that we're drinking. And in that context, talking about beers that we really like, you know, Massachusetts, Western Mass. There's not too many beers from Massachusetts that I've really had. I don't know if it's the Sam Adams thing.
Well, yeah, not a lot of stuff. I mean, not a lot of stuff comes in, particularly from Western Mass, makes it to New York City, at least not legally. So... yeah, it's kind of unusual.
It's about time.
Most of the breweries up there are pretty small, so but then all of a sudden there's quite a few. I actually lived up there for a year, 3 years ago, and there were a couple that were just starting out. Now there's a ton going on up there.
Which breweries were up there when you were there?
Amherst,
okay,
was there, and Northampton, and I think that was about it. And as soon as I left, like all these nano breweries started up. Element and
I'm not familiar with any of them.
No.
Yeah.
And there's a good beer bar up there, isn't it, in Northampton?
Yep. Dirty Truth, as well as Moan and Dove, which is in Amherst.
Yeah. We got some special guests here today. They're breaking the mold. They're making good beer up in Western Mass. We have the guys from Wandering Star Brewing in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. We got Alex Hall and Chris Kuzmi.
Hello.
How are you guys?
Fantastic. Hey, good.
So was it tough? Was it tough for you guys starting up in Massachusetts?
It took a hell of a long time, yes. We actually looked at first to open in North Adams. That fell through quite badly. But that was sort of a blessing in disguise. We got this place now in Pittsfield, and we're much better off actually being there than where we would have been in North Adams. But it really took years to get going.
Yeah,
one of the slower startups.
I've been talking to Chris Post about this, I think, since like 1998.
I think it was around 2003 or 2002, yeah. 2003 that we decided just to really kind of go for this.
Yeah, 2003, yeah. It's been 7 years.
Has gone
That's what I thought,
years.
Yeah. Wow.
But actually, as far as the location, going back to the location thing, it really worked out for us in the end on a multitude of levels. The roof ended up collapsing up in North Adams in the same space that we were dealing with, and so we were saved from that. And also, Chris was able to purchase the place that we have now, which is better than the lease deal that we had before. Also, we have a little bit more room to expand as far as we can expand up and not width-wise. Our ceilings are really high, and we can really change for mentors as needed
now
when
we
get there. Hopefully.
There was a brewery in Pittsfield, actually, when I was there, mm-hmm. that I think closed.
Yep.
Right?
Bill and Christine, yep.
And so what happened with them?
They were a brew pub situation, a small situation, small production, but they didn't want to have the restaurant anymore. They really enjoy making beer, and so they're moving on to try and do that and pursue that.
Facility.
And they also had two children in the meantime, so that's been slowed just a little bit, but we wish them the best and hope that it goes
soon. So do you think that's a good area to do a production facility, like what you're doing?
Yeah, for us, absolutely. I think it's also time for Western Mass to, you know, like you said earlier, Western Mass is starting to appreciate more craft, and so it's a good time for hitting that market right now. Although there's still we have a lot of room to grow, and there's much to do in that area of the state, you know.
Yeah.
All right. So, Alex, you've got a long story. You know, we've had you on the show before. You told about your love of Cask Ale, and for many years, your site was, Gotham Imbiber, right?
Yeah, GothamImbiber.com is my New York City site. It's a little out of date in places now because I'm so busy with the brewery and the other things I do, the cask festivals, and I'm looking after the cask cellar at DBA now, amongst other things. So Gotham hyphen Imbiber, GothamImbiber, IMBIBER.com. Started out as a magazine.
Can you say that again?
Don't make it. Yeah.
All right, pen and paper. Come on. What was the question again?
Well, we want to hear about you guys because it's you, this guy Chris Post, and Chris is—he's not here, is he?
unfortunately, Chris Post has been heavily delayed. There was a truck accident on Route 684, I think he said.
Now you can see why it took so long to open the brewery.
Yeah. Yeah. But hopefully he's going to make it at some point during the show. Last I heard, he was in the Bronx just before we went on air. So hopefully we'll make a bit of it.
But one of the things that also delayed him, I mean, we are pretty much just three people. We just have two people now helping out at the brewery. But Chris is up in Massachusetts all the time. But Alex and I are really – I'll go up there once or twice a month at best to help Chris brew. I mean, we met as brewers in the New York City Home Brewers Guild, and that's always been our passion. But we're doing it up there. But I'm not going to move from New York City as a musician and with all the things that I have involved in there, and Alex as well. So Chris really is – doing most of the work and most of the production, and he's got a lot on his plate in addition to being a wonderful father and a family man. And so part of his delay was that, you know, they needed these kegs from Albany. They were supposed to come pick up the kegs early on today. They were delayed, and then everything kind of got back.
Snowballed
from there, and then we got the accident on 684.
It was probably the truck that collected the kegs that had the accident. Ironic.
Well, we're giving you a hard time because we love you guys and we love some of your beers. So you got some interesting
just some
names.
Of them.
You got I had the Mild at Heart, right?
Oh, yeah.
And the what's it called? The Bash Biz
Bash
Bish Box.
We had those last night.
How did you come up with the Mild at Heart? Because that's been compared to some things like Troubadour Obscura.
It was my request to brew an English dark mild style ale. Chris Post went for it. Said nobody here brews an English style dark mild. It's a style that's been very largely ignored, and it's a big gap in the craft beer market here. So gonna have to go to Chris Kuzmi for the name.
We're rating for Alex's mild at stash.
Heart. This actually, it's, you know, mild at heart. It's an English dark mild. It made sense. We love it.
Fair
and
enough.
That's it.
And it's really tasty. Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
What are some other beers that you consider an English dark mild or something similar to that?
The only one that's readily available here, at least imported, is Morehouse's Black Cat in bottles. But I don't think bottles really sort of shine that much, reflecting the style. It really should be drunk from the cask. A fresh keg is good. But ideally from a firkin or a pin that's been well kept. If we put it in casks and kegs, it's a style that you rarely see. Barrier in Long Island have brewed a mild recently, and there are very few others. Oliver's that brew pub in Baltimore. They brew a mild. That's probably the only one I could think of otherwise.
When you're going to brew a beer, do you go like back to England and taste different examples of that beer, or do you find an old recipe?
Well, I'm not the brewer, don't forget.
You have to speak for him because I know.
What is Chris?
You guys, come on. Someone has to speak for the brewer.
Yeah, you're going to have to ask that one to Chris Post. I'm not the brewer. I request certain beers, such as the mild.
Well,
So he can say yes or no, because we're all partners in it, and we all discuss what we're going to do.
But it's a good question. I mean, it's you know, Chris Post isn't here, but Chris, excuse me, is. I mean, how do you go about this? I mean, for real, it's like you've got a style that hardly anyone's making, and you get inspired to make it. You know, what do you just follow a recipe? Do you have some mental imprint of tasting it?
Well, definitely a history of brewing and experiments brewing and knowing what flavors and kind of things you want and understanding ingredients and the experience that Chris already has from working at both Kelso, or Greenport Beer Works, and Chelsea Brewing Company. He was, you know, doing these kind of things, and also his home brewing. As home brewers, we had the advantage of, you know, not having to sell it. We could brew 5 gallons at a time, and so through that, we've done lots and lots of experimenting and really understanding our palate, and even just tasting grain. I mean, to imagine a flavor and then to put it into existence is a confusing thing for a lot of people, but through doing it over and over again and understanding the flavors that are all involved, you can design recipes to do that. And I think that actually Chris Post is able to go home a lot more than you are, Alex, right? Or you go back for the Cask Festival once a year.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Try and make another trip. Me and my wife are going back at the end of this month, actually, for a few days. It's our 10th wedding anniversary, so we're going to celebrate it in my hometown of Brighton. Love you, Felice, by the way. I know she's listening.
But real quick.
Sorry, going back to that. I nominally go back once a year because I still do a cask beer and music festival over there that I co-founded 16 years ago. So,
What was the name of that festival?
It's called Glastonwick. It's a play on words. The music part of it is a play on Glastonbury, the big music festival. What we do, me and a musician friend, Attila the Stockbroker, we founded it in 1996 as sort of an antidote to all these big music festivals that have crappy beer and real ale festivals, cask beer festivals that have some musician stuffed in the corner sort of doing like Bay City Rollers covers sort of thing, and like it's not good.
I remember that.
Yeah, so we throw both together in the same room and it works.
And as an example of what, you know, you can do to make different flavors happen, going back to that real quick, we just poured the mild at heart, but this is actually directly from the cask that Alex had at the Cask Festival. And I don't know if you remember from last night's festival, we had mild at heart on just a draft, and it was a lot sharper. This one, when Chris actually put it into the cask, he threw a little bit of lactose to kind of soften it out and have it be really nice in the cask. So this is different than...
It's really nice. I mean, I you know, it's you guys definitely have a niche doing sort of English-style ales, lots of cask. And I would think that it would help you up in that market, you know, up in Western Mass where you're trying to win people over and stuff, the beer is like really approachable, very easy drinking. I would think that would help you a lot.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, our Alpha Pale Ale was one of our lightest ones, and that went really well. We only make it in the summer, but we might make it all the time up there. It's yet to be decided.
How's, like, in terms of New York City, like, how's the response been in terms of... Because this is definitely, like, an underserved style.
Absolutely. It's been great. I mean, we've been getting a lot of really great response for the Mild at Heart in particular down in the city. It's one of those beers that extreme flavor without extreme alcohol, and it's great for pairing with a lot of different kinds of foods because of the complexity within it.
Yeah, I really like it. It's an interesting change from the gnarly wine.
Yeah. No, this is cool, and we're going to take a short break. We'll come back and talk more with the Wandering Star guys on Beer Sessions Radio. Welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. We're sponsored by GreatBrewers.com. GreatBrewers.com brings the American beer community together. Check them out. All right. Hey, we're here with Wandering Star Brewery, and especially with Chris Kuzme.
Hey.
Who's been a big guy in New York City beer. You're president now of the New York City Homebrewers Association.
Yes, which arguably is where this whole thing started.
Tell us about this, because it's like you guys are telling me about... There's a guy, Chris Post, who's not here, who makes the beer, and you got Alex Hall, who's the cask man, and you're the homebrew president.
The current,
like, how does this whole thing work?
So my first meeting at the New York City Homebrewers Guild, at the New York City Homebrewers Guild, was the same first meeting as Chris Post's back in 2002, I believe it was. We immediately became great friends, and then also through the beer scene, we ended up meeting Alex Hall. The beer scene in New York is... relatively small on the players within it, and so everybody kind of knows everybody. There's a great brotherhood, and it's awesome. It's fun.
Well, so many cool people have come out of it. Jen, yeah. Do you ever go to these meetings, the New York City Homebrewers Guild? And
I'm not a homebrewer. I've homebrewed once, and actually the anniversary of my one homebrewing experience is coming up here on Thanksgiving Day, and I would do it again. It's just so difficult to execute the feat in the alcove kitchen I have in my studio apartment in Manhattan. I mean, I can't to get a big enough pot onto my tiny little stove right there is a problem.
But you don't have to brew that much at a time.
I know. I have to go get one of those amazing little 1 gallon kits that our friends, I can't remember their names, they're selling.
Someone last night was telling me about Jen's apartment and said that when you walk into that apartment, it literally, there's... 6 packs of beer that she's saving, like it literally is the furniture.
It's under all the end tables.
It's like it looks like the whole apartment is built out of beer.
It's built out of beer, and the funny thing is, very rarely does anyone come visit me on the Upper West Side, and so it just kind of sits there, and it makes me happy just to see it around. But
Jen,
I don't drink alone that much.
You're so good at explaining things. If I've never made beer.
Okay.
And if I were to, I would want you to explain it to me how to do it.
Oh, right.
I'm
the one who's done it once. And I mean, at least I knew what I did wrong in the process. Because, you know, a lot of times somebody thinks they did everything perfectly and then they something goes wrong and they taste something they don't want to taste. Instead, I knew exactly what I did. I overboiled my aroma hops, because I was just, I had never done this before. I thought it was only going to take an hour to boil 6 gallons of liquid down to like 5.5 or 5 or whatever I needed to do. And so I started a timer to pitch all these aroma hops. And then I realized this liquid's not boiling as quickly as I thought. So I ended up having to boil it longer. And just like all those beautiful aromas that were going to come went right into like palate bitterness. So it was bitters.
So it seems easy, but then you actually have to do it.
Yeah. I mean, I did do a full grain mash right out of the gate. I never dealt with malt syrup. So I probably should have started at beginner level. And instead, I kind of went to a little bit more advanced. But, you know, at least I've seen the process. And yeah, once I get it down, I'll explain it to you, Jimmy. But you're better off asking Chris here, because he knows heck of a lot more than I do.
Do you have any of those bottles left?
Yeah.
Because I bet you that bitterness has come way down.
Yeah, it's I actually dipped into that beer, and I can still drink it. I mean, but what I call it is ugly baby IPA, a beer only a mother could love. You know, so it's like, I'm not going to throw it down the drain, but anybody else, I wouldn't hold it against someone.
Drinkable.
Yeah.
In 10 years, it, you know, probably be pretty good.
It was fun, though. It's a great process to see, you know, like I had read books about it and I envisioned it, but really to make beer with your own hands is a really fun process. Whether it comes out, whether it's great to drink or not, if you're a beer lover, to actually get your hands in it is really, it's very educational. Then when you tour a big brewery, you can actually take your tiny experience from your kitchen and relate it to all these huge tanks and contraptions and each step of the process you saw. So it's
and
fun.
It's the exact same process on a small scale
really
for
is.
A big scale.
Yeah.
It takes the same amount of time. It's just what you're doing, using to do it.
So, you know, there must be, you go to homebrew tasting, there's a lot of variation. And so what does the group function as? I mean, it's like a place for people to share, to learn.
The New York City Home Brewers Guild and the other beer clubs that also exist in the city, of which there are a lot now, thanks to the how easy
how many
it is
are
to
there?
Get ingredients. I'd say about 9 within all the 5 boroughs, or maybe even a little more.
That's a lot.
Staten Island has one too?
Staten Island has at least 2.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, they're great. And yeah, actually, I don't know about Harlem, but I bet you there's got to be one somewhere.
And you guys,
so what do we do?
Do you guys all get together, all the different homebrew clubs? I mean,
well, we're trying to change that a little bit, or not change it, but we're trying to, we're the oldest club, the New York City Homebrewers Guild. We're coming up on our 25th year anniversary in 2013. I've got plans for a giant homebrew expo party, which I'd love to divulge everything when we get it all set in motion. But stay tuned for that. It'll be, you know, April 13th area. 2013. Anyway, we're changing our website and want to make sure that, I mean, our club isn't necessarily the club for everybody. Like the people coming from Staten Island, that would be crazy. That's a long way to go. But we want to make sure when people look up homebrew in New York City, they can generally they come to the New York City Homebrewers Guild website, and we want to make sure that we have on our website just all those clubs listed and you know where they meet, when they meet. We all meet individually at different times throughout the month. None of them conflict generally. And what happens in a meeting is we get special guests, usually from breweries that are local or if people are visiting from out of town, they share their beer. We talk about their beer. We ask them really geeky and awesome questions about how it might help our individual homebrewing. And then at the end of that, we bust out and share all our homebrew amongst our brethren.
How would you say like that homebrew compares with like some of the commercial? Well, now that you are also part of a commercial brewery, mm-hmm. What are the differences? I mean, in terms of like these homebrewers that you're tasting, are they all making like pretty amazing beer?
Everybody's making pretty good beer. Yeah. I mean, thanks to clubs like this where you get the education and knowing what to do and what not to do. I mean, everybody, sure, at the start, you know, that we have these little, you know, things that we fail at or that, you know, just aren't totally
quite
right.
Yeah, are you
guys
like
right, honest
with each other? Like when someone makes
absolutely
a really horrible beer, like everybody go, oh man, this sucks.
Absolutely. Because, I mean, most of these people started as beer fans first. And, you know, as objective as we can all be about our own beer, we're more critical about our own beer. So a lot of times when you have a beer that's a little bad, a lot of these people are like, oh, it's not so good, but I want you to try it because I respect your opinion on what it is. And then that already, I mean, everybody's pretty blunt and
you're
honest with everybody
toast.
At the guild. I mean, everybody knows.
Well, and it's about
and
sharing
that's what it's
information.
There for. Yeah. And that's what we're there as a club to help each other become better brewers and, you know, explaining to people why some people don't know why certain things happen or why certain off flavors exist. And talking them through that is a good thing.
Has anyone else from that club gone commercial?
Absolutely. Actually, who one else? Of our founding members is a very commercial brewer. So the founding father, Morgan Wright, put out a blast on February 18th, 1988. I have a copy of a piece of paper written back to him from Garrett Oliver on March 13th of 1988, saying I'd love to really help get this thing started. And so Garrett Oliver of Brooklyn Brewery helped found this club. Greg Zaccardi from High Point Brewery in Ramstein, now Chris Post, of course. There are several of our members that have gone on and started their own breweries. Also Michael Kane in New Jersey, Kane Brewing Company, just started. The guys from Carton Brewing Company, Jesse Ferguson, they're good friends of ours. But I think he's only been to one or two meetings, but he was getting this thing off the ground, so I don't blame him. Outside of that, there are other people that have gone on. Our former president, Sean White, is working at Cascade Brewing now. And Douglas Constantiner is now starting a brewery. He worked with the brewery. I forget the name of the brewery that he's opening. He's in the process of opening it now. In California. Lots of people. I mean, it's great. It's awesome.
It's interesting. It's like, yeah. I don't know which came first, the chicken or the egg, but it seems like the home brewing community, you know, there's a definite similarity to the same sort of community among commercial craft brewers in the United States, probably worldwide, where they're all, you know, that's one of the things I've loved about it most is the fact that all these guys really are pushing each other to excel. Yeah. And open with their information and, you know, giving each other advice. And if a part breaks on a brewery, you call the brewery down the road and they jump to your rescue. And it's a really beautiful thing. And it sounds like homebrewing has that same sort of community with these clubs. And whether the commercial craft brewers who came out of homebrewing brought that to the table, or whether it's just one inspired the other, it's fantastic because, yeah, what's the result? Better beer. Better and better beer. I mean, and friendships and, you know, people coming together, which is what it's all about.
Right. And it also feeds the ability for these craft brewers to stay experimental and to stay afloat, because what's happening is, you know, we no longer have just people who love the libation. We have people who truly appreciate the art, and just that's creating a better understanding overall. And
I love how some of the commercial breweries like Stone collaborating with home brewers just to like show, like, this is where it all starts.
Yeah, it's awesome.
A lot of inspiration comes from that homebrew network.
Chris, what's the big, you do an annual homebrew event?
Yeah, I go to the National Homebrewers Conference, put on by the American Homebrewers Association. It changes location, just like the Craft Brewers Conference. And actually, this is an interesting point that that Jen just made about the brotherhood and camaraderie of... I went to the Craft Brewers Conference before I had gone to the American Homebrewers the National Homebrewers Conference. And I was so impressed at the Craft Brewers Conference about that brotherhood amongst commercial brewers. These are people that you know, you could look at it like they're fighting for room on the same, or they're fighting for those lines, they're fighting for the shelf space, you know, in a commerce. There's commerce involved. And but they're all hugs, and they're still only 5% of the market, and they're in this, you know, rising or tide floats all boats, right? So everybody's in it together and doing it. It's awesome. And then after that, a couple months later, I went to the National Homebrewers Conference, and it was awesome, because there is no conference. I mean, even though I didn't notice that there was commerce involved in the first one, the fact that there actually really was nothing on us just totally geeking out, being science nerds on Zymergy it's awesome. It's amazing.
It's almost pure because it is.
That conference is my wife's worst nightmare.
Nobody can write off.
Yeah. like 2,000 beer geeks in a room.
Have you been to it, Dave?
No. In fact, but I was talking to Beer Sensei, Warren Montero. He went.
Yeah, he went.
This past year for the first time, and he said it was incredible.
Yeah, yeah. It's cool. I mean, we have. So what happens there is we have the first night there is a beer festival, just like every other beer festival, where, you know, there are commercial breweries behind things and they're in support of the AHA. And then the next night it's club night. So we went as the New York City Home Brewers Guild, and we actually sent 21 kegs to California for this thing, and we set up behind our booth. And club night, there are themes, like there's the hop barley and the ailers, you know, they have that there. It's all, everybody does these crazy themes, and people go all out. And there's the Golden Urinal Award, which we are dedicated to getting at some point.
What is that?
The Golden Urinal Award is given to the homebrew club who brings the most kegs to that or to this session. Or to,
what's
to
the record so far? Do we know?
Last year was 160 kegs, I believe, something like that. It was absurd.
From which part of the country?
It was from California. So we will have an advantage. It's going to be in Philadelphia in 2 years. Next year it's in Seattle. And when it's in Philadelphia,
so you can rent a tractor trailer.
It's our mission to get the New York City Over is to get this damn
golden urinal. We want that urinal on this show.
Yeah, that's right. We will bring the urinal to Beer Sessions Radio. I make it my life duty.
Wow.
You got to have something to work on. Yeah. You got to have a goal.
Yeah, goals are important.
Wow.
Cool. There's one word you said. You said Zymergy.
Zymergy. Zymergy. Okay. Zymergy.
So that's something to do with beer, right?
That's the art of fermentation.
Okay. Let's go around the room. Everybody say a word about beer that I don't know. You said Zymergy.
That's what pretty easy.
What's a word, a beer that describes...
Don't start with me. I got to think about that now.
I know. What are you doing to us, Jimmy?
I'm going to try to elevate the conversation. Zymergy, that's pretty intense.
It's a good word.
It's a great word.
Yeah. Where did that come from?
That's also the name of the Homebrewers Guild... Or, I'm sorry, the Homebrewers Association publication. They have a magazine. If you become a member of the AHA... You get this magazine subscription, which is worth it in itself, except that you also get a little membership card that various beer bars in New York City and also the Brooklyn Brewery, you can get discounts or a free drink token at the Brooklyn Brewery, you know, for being a member.
Pediococcus.
That's a good one.
Do
you know what that is, Jimmy?
I bet Alex has a word that I don't know.
Ullage. Have you heard of that one? I've not heard that. This side of the Atlantic.
How do you spell that?
Ullage.
What is that? Something about the beer that flows over the edge or something?
Well, you're on the right track.
All right.
It's like spoiled beer, unsalable beer. Whether it be infected or has gone bad, just whatever's in a cask or a keg that is unsalable. That's the British term, ullage. Ullage. So I've never, ever heard it this side of the Atlantic.
Dave, what was your word again?
Pediococcus.
And what's
no
that?
Relation to your friend Greg.
Yeah. What? Tell me what that means.
It's a yeast strain.
No, it's bacteria.
It's a bacteria. It's bacteria. Infection. Sorry, not a yeast strain.
It's an infection. And don't get it anywhere near any cellar that I'm keeping. I don't want it.
It creates a sort of stringy, you know, it's actually like, you know, when you were a kid, you would get a cold like that. And it's
sick beer.
It's sick beer, and then apparently the stringiness goes away, right? It'll eventually. Remember
yeah.
We were talking about
we learned from Jean Van Roy of Cantillon, and right. It was fascinating. He's talking about when they're making lambic, the beer often gets sick, and it is like a human; it recovers, but you've got to be patient. The temperature has to reach a certain point for a certain number of days. Sometimes they can sit on a batch of beer for years, waiting for it to get well again. And so it's really a commitment if you've got the sick beer because it takes up space. So it's fascinating.
I've had pediococcus since like last Sunday.
Ropey. Dave's feeling a bit ropey.
I've been very ropey.
Dave, you're hanging out too much with the Vermont guys.
We were like harvesting carrots at their farm and then potatoes at my farm, and it was wet and there was snow. And
The first cousin of pediococcus is lactobacillus. Again, don't want that in any car cellar. No way.
It depends on what kind of beer you're making. I mean, and it's funny, all the, like, I know Russian River is in the heart of wine country, and all those, like, winemakers steer clear of all that bacteria. Yeah, the last thing they want to take home is bacteria like that, and yet, you know, if you make sour beers, it's what makes them sour. So right. we've got to love it, too. It can be a love-hate relationship.
And it's not just sour stuff, too. I mean, or it's not just sourness that it attributes, or there are different kinds of sour. So lactobacillus is a bit more creamy and milky, whereas Brettanomyces dries it out and makes it really...
And makes it funky and a little barnyardy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sweet.
Are you learning something, Jimmy? I hope you're learning something.
I am. I'm going to look at my notes about Zymergy. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio.
Hug and kiss and feel.
Welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio. He's here. We've been waiting for him for half an hour. Chris Post, the actual brewer from Wandering Star. Now we can ask you the real questions. We talked about Zymurgy and
Alex was being very political for the bacteria. Last half hour. He wouldn't answer a single question.
The first question is, Chris, I've been dying to talk to you for years. You got Wandering Star up and running. Where were you born and where are you from?
I'm from England, south of England. I was born actually in Kent, which is the kind of hop-growing area of England. And, yeah, pretty much the house I was born in neighbored on a hop field at the back.
Wow. All right. So what's it like? You picked up Pittsfield, Massachusetts. We talked a little bit about Western Mass. There's not too much beer up there. Why did you settle on Western Massachusetts?
Well, I was living in New York City and actually working in a bank, you know, as before I started making an honest living. And like a lot of people up there in that part of Massachusetts, there's a lot of weekend homes there. And that's when I started going up there. And over the years, I loved the place more and more. And banking loved me less and less. So when me and banking parted company in 2006, I moved up there permanently with dreams of the whole brewing enterprise, and spent a lot of time in New York, worked at a couple of breweries here in New York City just to get the commercial brewing experience, but always with an eye on starting a brewery up there.
Did you give yourself like a subprime loan before you quit the bank?
if only I had. Though I think I probably was one of the last people actually out there to get any form of a loan in 2008.
Oh, so you did get a bank loan?
When we bought our brewery building, yeah.
That's like almost impossible.
I shudder to think how difficult it would be now. For sure.
So Western Mass, what's it like up there? We've heard different things about licensing and everything. Tell us a little bit about your experience getting that brewery open. You started up in North Adams, Mass.
It was one of the fastest startups, actually, in history, right? I mean,
we looked in a number of locations. What the Berkshires is it's an absolutely beautiful area, but it is also an area with a lot of old mill towns in it, as you know, Jimmy. And a lot of those mills are, you know, standing there, semi-derelict, and there isn't a lot of new commercial building going on. So while I was looking for locations, I was being shown places by commercial real estate agents that, frankly, were just no way going to be suitable for a brewery. You know, I'd come around a corner and there'd be something burning in an oil drum, and what the heck is that? And it's like, you want me to put basically a food facility in this building? So it clearly wasn't going to work, but there wasn't a lot of commercial space. And eventually, as with so many things, it seems, over the years, we did get lucky. I was driving down the road, kind of bemoaning the fact that some lease negotiations on space in North Adams, in the north of Berkshire County, those lease negotiations are basically, we'd had to call a stop to it. I looked to my right while I was driving along, kind of feeling self-pitying. And there was a commercial building with a for sale sign outside it. And that's eventually where we bought.
That's a great story. And I remember last week when we were talking to the guys up in Athens with Crossroads Brewery, and they, you know, have gone through 8 years to get their brewery up. But when it happened the way it was supposed to happen. And it sounds like that happened for you guys, too. You know, it's a long story, but then it turns out with a happy ending.
I think so. I mean, you know, I think we took our chances when they came along. And I think we're lucky in the area that we're in. There aren't any other microbreweries in our immediate locality. There is a Berkshire Brewing Company, which is the kind of big regional brewery up in Western Massachusetts, actually isn't in Berkshire County. And in a way, that has given us a niche because a lot of the local bars and restaurants want a beer that's genuinely local. There have been some very good brew pubs in the neighborhood, but they haven't really thrived and prospered to the extent that they'd still be in business. So there is definitely a kind of gap for great beer, and it's one that we wanted to fill with beer that we can sell locally, but also at every point, you know, we've had our eye in bringing the beer down to New York City.
You've also, we were talking earlier before you got here about there's been like a real renaissance of small breweries in that area, like within the last 2 years, Element and a bunch of other places. I mean, what are some of your favorites that have kind of popped up around you?
I love the beer that Element is making. You know, I think that now that Dan Kramer, the brewer there, who was previously at Opa Opa, now he's moved up to Element, it's really given him scope to kind of explore his creative side and to be making some wackier beers than he was making.
Yeah, because Opa Opa is also in that area.
And that's right. And it's very much, you know, Opa Opa is another local brewery that is, I think, it's first and foremost a brew pub.
It's like a steakhouse, right? Or
that's right. Yeah, yeah, they have a really, really good steakhouse in Williamsburg in Massachusetts. That's right. The other Williamsburg.
The other Williamsburg, yeah.
That's right.
So how big is your system right now?
We have a 15-barrel system. Okay. When we actually started off looking at the brewery, or starting up about 6 years ago, everyone told us that we were crazy to be starting with a 15-barrel brewery. It was way too small. And they told us that 20 barrels seemed to be, you know, the lowest you could possibly go, maybe 30 barrels.
Oh, we know better than that.
I think we know better than that now. I mean, what's interesting, and going back to Dave's comment, is that there have been so many small breweries opening, in particular in Massachusetts, and the whole nano brewery, I mean, that wasn't even a word that was around, that had been coined by when we were looking at starting up. And I think the idea of how large a brewery has to be viable has definitely changed.
So you're saying, did you have your equipment before you started?
We were in too deep. We were past the point of no return even before we started.
You couldn't give up.
Tell me, where'd you get your equipment? Where'd you get it? And what was the deal?
I was sitting on the trading floor at Greenwich Capital one day back in 2004, and I was literally bored out of my gourd, and I was flipping through eBay as one does. And I'd started homebrewing 2.5 years ago before that. So in 2001, and you know, I'd really gotten the bug pretty badly. And so I was kind of flipping through eBay with the keyword search term brewing.
You bought a brewery on eBay?
I bought a brewery on eBay. Yeah. It's like,
that's
a piece of history.
And it was for sale at what seemed and eventually proved to be a ridiculously kind of a steal of a price. So I put in a
bid. Who was selling it? Where did it come from?
It came from Michigan, from a brew pub that had gone out of business on Lake Michigan. And the new owners of the property that this brew pub had been in had basically paid someone to rip this pretty much brand new system out. And I bought it for about 5% of its original price.
Oh, my God.
And it had been brewed on 17 times. That was it.
Were you competing against other bidders? Or
no,
were you the only one?
This was the really strange
thing. Because that would be interesting.
Thing.
Like, wait until the last 5 minutes and put in your last bid.
Well, I bid on it, and I thought, you know, I thought, there's nothing going to happen. And then 3 days' time, I got an email from eBay telling me that I'd won, you know, item number. And it was like... What was that?
Was that the brewery?
Was that crock pot that I brewed on? Oh my goodness! All right. Well, do you take PayPal on this one? What are the shipping costs? So we were, like I said, we were in kind of too deep right from the very start, and had the brewery, all the equipment in storage for a number of years while we looked for the right location, and once we had the right location, we simply had to carry on.
And how are the 15 barrels working out for you? Do you feel like that really was the right size to start with?
I think it's a great size to be actually brewing on. Our limitation is not the size of the brew house itself. It's the amount of fermentation capacity that we have.
But Chris was saying before, this Chris was saying that you have the ceiling height to be able to expand your fermenters and...
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that's good news. First thing on the shopping list is definitely more primary fermentation. But in the meantime, it's actually our lack of primary fermentation has led to some happy accidents. For example, when we were looking at making a Saison this year, one of our constraints being primary fermentation, we have to get the beer out of primary and into secondary fermentation or conditioning as quickly as possible. And given that, I did a bunch of research on Saisons, in particular in Phil Markowski's great book on farmhouse ales. And I learned about the DuPont yeast, The Brasserie DuPont, basically their yeast is almost unique in that you brew or you ferment at an incredibly high temperature with that yeast. It's great for brewing during high summer. Turn your chiller off, watch your electricity bills drop, and watch the beer ferment. We had it up to 98 degrees.
Oh my gosh.
Which is, yeah, a good 30 degrees warmer than your standard ale fermentations, and most ale yeasts would be producing some disgusting flavors at that temperature. Now, the reason that Brasserie DuPont uses this yeast was, I thought that this was a great coincidence, is because they, before Saison picked up in vogue again over the last few years, they were chronically cash-strapped and chronically short of primary fermentation. So they had exactly the same issue as wanting to get their beer out of primary as quickly as possible. And I just thought that was a great parallel between what they, the way that their yeast had evolved and their brewing practices had evolved, and the way that we had to do it ourselves.
Things haven't changed too much.
I think Brasserie DuPont has a lot more money than it used to, but it's still keeping on using that great yeast.
Right.
Well, sweet. Chris, what was the first beer that you brewed when you became licensed?
The first beer that we brewed when we became licensed was... I'm not going to mention the ones we brewed before we became licensed.
The unmentionables.
The unmentionables. The first ones we did when we were licensed, actually the first one was a pretty interesting one. It was a beer that had won the New York City homebrew competition back in January of this year. Or to be absolutely correct, it hadn't won it. It had been disqualified from the main competition because the brewer had left a label on the bottle, and the rules for these competitions are incredibly strict. I mean, you know, just very, very strict. But we were running a parallel competition for which the prize was brewing on our system, and this beer entered that competition and won it hands down, which we just thought was very, very funny. Even funnier when I learned that it was actually a local home brewer in Western Massachusetts.
What was the beer?
It was an Imperial Stout, a Russian Imperial Stout. We called it Burt's Disqualified Imperial Stout.
That's a gross one about that
we
name.
Ignored all the cries of fix ringing in our ears, and we just brewed it.
Really, it wasn't a fix.
And what about your recipes? I mean, there's other... So this Bash Biz Bock, which I like a lot. Whose recipe is that?
That's mine, and in fact, that's almost two recipes in one. That was kind of an interesting one as well. This was the first lager that we brewed, and we didn't have... We got a lager yeast, a Wyon Stefan lager yeast, but we didn't really have enough for me to be comfortable with brewing the whole 15 barrels. Lager yeast, you do need to pitch a bit more yeast than you traditionally do with ales to be able to keep to that kind of true lager character of a very clean fermentation. So we brewed 7 barrels. I figured that if we brew 7 barrels on Friday, let it just basically work itself up over the weekend and brew another 8 barrels on Monday and add that wort to the fermenting yeast, then we'd be fine. We'll do it like that. So we, you know, I'd made up this recipe pretty much, not on the fly, I mean, you know, a good amount of research involved, but really going for trying to get a traditional bock, but on the drinkable side, you know, not a very heavy, sticky beer, but something that was definitely a traditional German bock, but that you'd want to drink a lot more than one of. Over that weekend, so we brewed the first 7 barrels, pretty happy with it. Over that weekend, I went to a local beer bar, had some Einbecker My Urbock. I went, okay, fine, let's rewrite the recipe. And so the second 8 barrels, the recipe was, not only was it completely different because it had to kind of overcompensate for what I then saw as the shortcomings in the first 7 barrels. So the result was a blend of the two, and I was very, very pleased by the way that came out.
Bish.
But Chris, if you could, would you do all cask ale? Do you like cask ale?
I love cask ale. No, I wouldn't do all of it. Firstly, because, as Alex would be able to testify if he ever cleaned a cask before sending it up to the brewery.
Chris, that piece of equipment you sent me didn't work. Okay. So that's my excuse.
Thank you for telling me now, 3 months after I sent it to you. Okay. Cask is wonderful. It's an anachronism. It's a terribly inefficient way of getting beer into a pint glass in a lot of ways in this, you know, kind of in this modern age. The casks are a total pain to clean. The beer doesn't last very long. It's unstable, it's unpredictable, and it changes over time. And all of these drawbacks are also the things that make it unique and wonderful. I love doing cask ale, but at the same time, you know, I don't want to stop also brewing beers that are true to German or Belgian or other or US craft beer traditions. So I don't think we'll ever switch entirely to cask.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about the Saison that you did that brought in elements of your local area. I think you used some malt from the, is it the Valley Maltster? What's the name of the couple that are?
Christian and Andrea Stanley.
Yeah.
That's right, at Valley Malt in Hadley. It's the only malt house east of the Mississippi, I understand. Yeah, the Saison, as I mentioned, I mean, we were very true to the Belgian tradition in terms of the brewing techniques. But one of the things about farmhouse ales is that a lot of it is in the yeast, a lot of it is in the fermentation in common with other Belgian beers. And there isn't so much, basically, it seems to me that the tradition was, let's put in whatever grain we have. And so, you know, we had almost free rein as to what grain and malt we would use. Shortly before we brewed that, the Massachusetts ABCC had tried to come out with a rule requiring all farmer breweries to use over 50% of local malt and hops.
Which is basically impossible for most people.
Well, it wasn't impossible for us.
Not
we
for
did
you.
It, but we absolutely did it. But what it did, and this highlighted the absurdity of their rule, is it basically cleaned the state out of malt for the next month.
Just one beer.
Just one brew. That's right. So so it kind of pretty much highlighted how absurd that rule was, given that there are a couple of other farmer breweries in the state that I'm sure, you know, some listeners have heard of, like Harpoon and Sam Adams.
Huge farmer breweries.
And Cisco, exactly.
Yes, that
huge farmers.
That law got repealed, by the way.
Well, Chris, listen, we do have another show coming on after us, so we want you back. And who are these little guys running around?
My sons, Alex and Andrew, patiently sat in the car as I struggled my way through the traffic.
That's a different Alex, by the way, just in case you didn't twig that.
And the little one is not named after this one. They're great kids. They spend a lot of time in the brewery, and I'm happy to report that Alex could tap a keg at 2 years old.
Excellent. Chris Kuzmi, well, let's go through some events. We're wrapping the show up. Chris, anything that Wandering Star, anywhere in New York City, Wandering Star will be?
Well, actually, we have an event happening on Thursday, which is our friend Josh Bernstein just wrote a book called Brood Awakening, and he's doing a series of different book release parties, and Thursdays will feature us. Mm-hmm. We'll have all six of our beers on at Pacific Standard in Park Slope.
All right. Anything happening at Blind Tiger for good beer seal bar events?
We got Rob Todd in the house from Allagash Beer tomorrow night with an amazing list.
Wow, that's pretty kicker. And Jimmy's number 43. It's Meat Week. We got Josh Bernstein on Wednesday night.
Yeah,
we're doing all Shelton Brother beers this week. And next week, November 19th, we're doing a thing called Five Brewers Brunch. We got Wandering Star, Blind Bat, Barrier, Pretty Things, and Crossroads. They're all coming down for
brunch.
I will
make a beer for you.
Please, I wish you would. Alex, what else? Special event.
I want to say that Wandering Star Mild, the Mild and the Bock are both on cask at this time at DBA Brooklyn, 113 North 7th in Williamsburg. There's two casks, the Mild and the Bock, like right on now. So,
both tasting lovely.
Come down and enjoy.
And since we're doing Twitter a lot, what's the Wandering Star Twitter hashtag or whatever it is?
Wandering Star CB.
So at Wandering Star CB?
Yep.
All right.
Craft.
And here's something coming up next week on November 15th, Beer Sessions Radio. We'll participate in a special Coast to Coast, Toast to Toast, celebrating Van Bergen de Wolf's 30th anniversary.
With toast.
Talk about Saison DuPont that we know that Van Bergen de Wolf saved them. They were just about to stop making Saison 30 years ago. And Don Feinberg said he loved the beer, and next thing you know, it's a classic. But way back then, they were on the verge. We would not know Saison today if it were not for Van Bergen de Wolf. So take a look at BelgianExperts.com for more information on the coast-to-coast, toast-to-toast. We'll be doing it at Jimmy's Number 43, I can say that. And I know a few other places will be as well. And there's a hashtag, it's C2CT. But we're at beer sessions_beer. I can't do it on the radio, but if you're on Twitter, you can find us, all right? I'd like to thank our sponsors, greatbrewers.com, and our sponsor, goodbeerseal.com. So thanks a lot to everybody. There's a lot of guests here. We got Jen, Dave, Chris, Alex, and Chris joining me here on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks to our producers, Jack Inslee and Bree O'Connor. We'll see you next time on Beer Sessions Radio.
Woo!
Roll cheers. Out the barrel in me your ears. I like beer. It makes me a jolly good fellow. I like beer. It helps me unwind. And sometimes it makes me feel mellow.
Makes him feel mellow.
Thanks. Whiskey's too rough. Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our programs in iTunes by searching the store for Heritage Radio Network. And you can find all of our archived programs on our website, heritageradionetwork.com. Follow us on Twitter at HRN Updates and friend us on Facebook, Heritage Radio Network. Thanks for listening. Special thanks to Carlos. The following is a message from Jones Family Farms. Jones Family Farms is a 400-acre working farm offering quality agricultural products all year round, from fresh summer berries to Christmas trees in the winter, and an award-winning winery that is open from April to December. The reach of the Jones Family Farms is hard to capture, from their advocacy work through the Working Lands Alliance to ongoing classes in the Harvest Kitchen. Jones Family Farms is as passionate about education as it is about farming. Whether you're picking fresh strawberries or exploring local wines, we hope you're inspired to learn more about Connecticut farming. Visit www.jonesfamilyfarms.com for more information.